KZSU-FM Stanford, welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I am a non-resident fellow at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School, as well as an assistant professor of law at the Charlotte School of Law in Charlotte, North Carolina. Thank you for joining me today on Hearsay Culture. Today I'm very excited to have on one of the authors of the book Spycraft, The Secret History of the CIA Spy Texts from Communism to Al-Qaeda. And the author is Bob Wallace. His co-author is H. Keith Melton, and Henry Robert Schlesinger are unable to join us today on the show. But in our discussion today, we're going to be looking at this book, which focuses literally, as the subtitle suggests, on the history of technology use by the CIA itself, but also in espionage in general. And this is an area, of course, where on Hearsay Culture, we haven't discussed directly, but we've certainly discussed the use of technology as it relates to issues involving privacy and individual liberty and so forth. And here in Spycraft, Bob gives us the opportunity, and it is a unique one, to get into the history of the use of technology by way of various stories based upon his own experience and involvement that he's had, some of which stories that are well known, like the Penkovsky Papers case, and others which are not known at all and were revealed and discussed in more detail in this book. So I'm very excited to have Bob on today. We're going to be exploring not only the history of the use of technology by the CIA and its Office of Technical Services, but also talking a bit about how technology is used generally and what technology can do and cannot do as it relates to intelligence gathering. Bob Wallace perhaps is uniquely qualified to co-author a book of this magnitude. Bob is the former director of the CIA's Office of Technical Service, a recipient of the CIA's Intelligence Medal of Merit. He founded the Artemis Consulting Group in 2004, providing management and intelligence counsel to corporate and government clients. He's also a contributor to the Oral History Program of the CIA's Center for the Study of Intelligence, and he's joining us today by telephone. Without further ado, Bob, because this is such a fascinating area and I want to dive right in, thank you for joining us today on Hearsay Culture.
Dave, I'm very pleased to be with you and your audience, and I look forward to an exciting discussion.
Bob, let's dive in. Normally when I interview authors, I have a general question that I ask, and I think it's particularly interesting here because, again, it's not all that often that someone with your experience in intelligence gathering and at CIA authors a book that we can then get into in some detail on a radio show. So I'm excited to have you on today. And perhaps for the benefit of listeners, you could talk more about your background and how you got into this particular area of focusing on that technology use in espionage.
I am a 32-year veteran of Central Intelligence Agency. I joined in 1971 after a stable of Army Rangers in Vietnam, and then I worked for a while with a congressman here in Washington, subsequently joining the CIA and spending the next 25 years as an operations officer. In the early 1990s, I came back to Washington, was reassigned back to Washington, and held a couple of administrative management jobs in CIA headquarters, including a stint in the comptroller's office, where I had the fascinating opportunity to deal with budgets and numbers, especially during a period of time when the CIA was undergoing a downsize. Then in 1995, I was asked by the Deputy Director for Operations, the individual who runs all clandestine operations worldwide for the agency, to become the deputy in the Office of Technical Service. The Office of Technical Service builds all the sites for our agents and our officers to use any place in the world. I'm not a technology guy. I'm a history major. And I said to the deputy director at the time, why me? And the response on that was fairly short and straightforward. He said, well, there are plenty of engineers and technical people over in the Office of Technical Service. What I want is an operations guy who will watch what is being done sure that it is both applicable for our espionage operation and that it works when we deploy it. So that's how I got the Office of Technical Service.
So it's interesting because you've already identified something which seems counterintuitive because you said you're not a technology person but involved in history, and perhaps the follow-up question there is how is your background in that area useful to you, and how was it useful to you in your role at OTS?
Well, I had, as I mentioned, 25 years as an operations officer, so I had a lot of experience in that side of the business. Anyway, from the standpoint of being a history major, that's actually the liberal arts background or the liberal arts education seems to be especially useful in the more senior management position, because I think the liberal arts background, the liberal arts education gives you an appreciation for the breadth of information that is always available. It gives you perhaps some skill in asking questions and integrating information that comes to you from all variety of sources. And then finally, I don't think one can ever underestimate or understate the value in being able to develop collaboration relationships with people who get projects done. You both have to work upward laterally and downward as you do in any large bureaucracy.
When you're writing a book, obviously, that focuses on an organization like CIA, who's built largely or perhaps exclusively on secrecy, obviously there are challenges to writing in this area. And so perhaps I'll ask you what those difficulties were in connection with the, quote, official message of the CIA that you include in a book, and perhaps rather than give it away, perhaps you could talk about how you included that message in the book.
As a CIA officer, like all of my colleagues, when we join the organization, we then become subject to a lifelong obligation to protect classified information that comes to our attention, or activities, classified information that we activities that we're involved in, and to ensure that that is done systematically and then professionally. The CIA has an organization that is the Publications Review Board, and this board's role is to look at any papers, publications, or speeches, books that CIA officers would write and publish to ensure that it does not include any classified information. Now, in parallel, there is a recognition that as Americans, the people don't forfeit their First Amendment rights when they join the CIA or any government organization for that matter. And so, in writing this book or any other publication for that matter, the CIA has a requirement that the disclaimer be included in the book to alert the reader that this is not official U.S. government material that is being presented. As a writer, I am not speaking on behalf of the United States government. I'm not speaking on behalf of the Central Intelligence Agency. I'm relating my own particular perspective. And that's what the disclaimer does say.
And the format of the disclaimer, I think, is particularly clever. Perhaps you could talk about that. How do you physically include it in the book?
We thought we were quite ingenious in this regard, because as far as we know, it's never been done before. And despite that, we included the disclaimer, but we put it in a cipher, in a code, if you will. And this is the same cipher and the same code. We call it a one-time head that was used by one of the CIA's special agents in the Soviet Union in the mid-1970s. This agent had a particular code, a particular one-time pad
When I came across that, because it's fairly early in the book, and I think for anyone that's used to reading books about CIA, often we find that these books are written by individuals that appear to have perhaps an axe to grind with respect to the agency, or certainly they're looking to do a certain amount of whistleblowing. And I guess what I'll ask you is, because I think it's an interesting point, for example, using the one-time pad to encrypt in a way that can be solved by using the one-time pad in the book, the CIA's messages might be, I think, by those perhaps looking at the book from a certain perspective or through a certain lens, as maybe a poke in the eye or a gentle poke in the eye at CIA. Perhaps because oftentimes we read books from people that have particular concerns about the agency, I'll ask you that direct question. In terms of your interactions with the agency and your authoring of this book, does any of it involve concerns in particular about CIA or about intelligence gathering generally?
I can be very precise, I think, in responding to that question. When we talked about using the cipher, the one-time pad cipher, for the CIA disclaimer, for the disclaimer that we're required to include, I thought we think cipher is a word that's thrown around commonly, and one talks about espionage, but very few folks, unless they have actually worked in the field, understand how precise, laborious, labor-intensive that using ciphers really is. What we call this covert communication in the broadest sense. And covert communication is at the heart of espionage. And in fact, it takes a level of discipline on the part of the agent to decipher messages that he's really quite remarkable, especially when he's using one time pad. And so at one level, we said, you know, if we could do this, we could perhaps share with the reading public a greater sense of what the profession is really all about. The second element was, we throw around the term one-time pad very readily. It appears in many different other books or publications about intelligence. But once one really experiences what it is and how it works, I don't think you get quite the level of appreciation for its security as you do actually get working on one of these fibers. So those are the two reasons we put it in to answer your question directly. I don't think they entered either piece of my mind that we somehow tried to make another statement with respect to the applicability or not of the claim itself.
Yeah, and it's which is why I wanted to ask the question, because, like I said, oftentimes you do see books of this nature being written in a way that would suggest that the author resented the fact that they had to put that notation in. I think it's interesting that here, as you indicate, the purpose of doing that is quite different to illustrate some of the onerous or laborious ways in which encryption takes place in practice. In your forward,
comment for one addition.
Sure, please.
They have done dozens, scores of interviews since the book was published last June, and it's always interesting to me that there is sometimes the expectation that, well, the book must have some axe to grind. Or it must be going to attack some personality, either a political or an intelligence personality. And the answer is no. Well, that is really not our intent. One of our main objectives is to credibly fill a void in operated during the Second World War. There was a man named Stanley Lovell, or Stanley from Boston. And Stanley Lovell wrote a book called Of Spies and Stratagems about the technology and the technical devices of OSS. That was published in 1963. About between 1963 and publication of Spycraft last year. And as far as we know, no one has ever attempted to write another history on the technical gadgets and spies.
And I did notice that, although I think it would be appropriate for me to note something we chatted about briefly before the interview, which is, of course, your co-author's book illustrating a number of the technological devices over the years that are in his collection, a book that I personally enjoy.
Mr. Melton is the co-author of the world's largest private collection of spyware, and he's actually published three or four photo-related books about the various types of spyware. The most recent one is called The Ultimate Spy.
Yes.
This is actually the reason that this book, Spycraft, was written, because after I retired, I had been studying with me for a few years, and after I retired, I've got all this spy gear in my possession. Now, I kind of know how it works, but what I don't know is the history of how it was developed and examples of operations it was used in.
Mm-hmm.
And you could supply that perspective on the book, and I could supply additional gadgets and explanations of those. So that seems to be like a winning combination to look at, and in fact, the books by them does contain about 200 either pictures, descriptions, or illustrations of various spy gear, and how they use.
One of the interesting ways you open the book, and again, the substance of the book, and we are chatting with author Bob Wallace, co-author of the book Spycraft, The Secret History of the CIA Spy Techs from Communism to Al-Qaeda, here on Hearsay Culture on KZSU-FM Stanford. You note in your foreword, Bob, and I actually want to read it and just talk about it briefly, but you say, regrettably, there have been instances when secrecy was invoked to deny knowledge of information that has long since lost sensitivity but is vital for the public's understanding and consideration. Such misuse of secrecy can result in flawed policy decisions, wild speculation about the CIA's activities, and a misleading historical record. For the CIA to maintain the public trust, responsible and accurate presentation of information on intelligence subjects is both wise and necessary. And this, again, I think, reflected something about, as you mentioned, your intention to writing the book. But I was, in order for us to get into some of this discussion, I'm curious to run technology through this prism of unwarranted secrecy. And so perhaps you could explain a little bit more what you mean by that statement, and perhaps why you included it, with a follow-up being, can you talk about any specific examples of decisions about which you're personally aware when such secrecy led to bad results? And
the issues as they unfolded, though, in the committee, clearly focused on things that had largely on activities that had happened and occurred in the 1950s and the early 1960s. Activities that had been held very basic, but authorized by the administration, the Eisenhower, Kennedy, Johnson, the Nixon administration. And I think it served as an example. Bill Colby was the director of CIA at the time. And Bill Colby had to defend actions, policies that were more than 20 years old. And I think it's probably a pretty good example of why secrecy, and certainly in the minds of the people who opposed the secrecy for patriotic reasons, but the secrecy did not serve the institution or necessarily policy as you are aware of it. Sure. The second element of your question, and now I'm expanding the Bob Wallace perspective, is that in the 1950s and 1960s, the CIA was a very young organization, and so its intelligence operations and secrets were all very new. Over time, it seems to me, created by conclusion, that secrets are something like radioactivity. There's a decay factor. There's a half-life. And in some secrets, that half-life may well be essentially long. In most, though, it is not the case. And secrets that are very significant at a particular time over the course of years, that the importance of that secrecy steadily rose. And I think now, in the 21st century, with the CIA is an organization that's 60 years old, is reducing the number of these secrets that are held very tightly by this young organization.
And I do want to talk about the technology that you discuss in great detail in the book after the break, but I do want to ask you this question before the break, Bob, which really follows up on that, which is really from a policy perspective or perhaps from an operative perspective in the CIA, can an organization that is, you know, broadly built upon not only secrecy but obviously efforts in intelligence gathering, which can include activities that we would call deceptive or activities to mislead, can an organization that has as its core goal intelligence gathering, which by its very nature requires a certain amount of confidentiality and secrecy, incorporate this broad concern about using transparency in a way to benefit its decisions? In other words, can CIA incorporate this idea in its operations? And if so, how?
It's a question that perhaps surprisingly to some who have not been associated with the business and so regularly discussed inside among those of us who are professionals, because I think fundamental culture within the agency that realizes that, you know, a secret organization
We are talking with Bob Wallace, co-author of the book Spycraft, The Secret History of the CIA Spy Techs from Communism to Al-Qaeda, here on Hearsay Culture. For those of you that listen to the show regularly, you know that Hearsay Culture is on KZSU-FM Stanford. And, perhaps you're listening to the show. Hopefully you are listening to the show live on KZSU. KZSU is a nonprofit, non-commercial radio station at Stanford University that requires donations from listeners like you to continue its diverse programming. If you are interested in making a donation to KZSU, you have a couple of options. You can first email our underwriting department at underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Again, that's underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Or alternatively, you can go to kzsu.stanford.edu, the webpage for the radio station, and click on Donate to KZSU. Regardless, I do hope that you consider making a donation to KZSU, and even if you listen to the show by podcast, please consider making that donation, as KZSU remains and will continue to remain the home of Hearsay Culture. Bob, let's talk about this technology, and perhaps we've used this term, and you identified yourself as the head of OTS initially, excuse me, and as we turn towards technology, perhaps you could tell us a little bit about the history of OTS in particular, and then get into perhaps if you have a main example of how technology has helped and a main example of how technology perhaps has hindered the operations of CIA.
Okay, you have a couple of questions there, so remind me if I don't touch on them all when I begin responding.
Of course.
But the element that I think is most fundamental is the Office of Technical Service is not in the business of making cool gadgets. They want to be in the business of saying, can't we produce the neatest new thing on the newest technology today and make it look new and special. The job of the technical service is spy gear that works, applying the best American technology or foreign technology, for that matter, what is available to us, to the particular operational needs for that gear. OTS is remarkable not only for some of the technical work it did, but for its survivability, if you will, or perhaps more importantly, its effectiveness as an organization, government organization that has a history. Any government organization, a particular bureaucracy, come and go rapidly over the course of years, but OTS originally formed in 1961 as the Technical Service Staff. This was before satellites, before we had reconnaissance aircraft like the DC-2. And the idea at the time was to try to recreate the family level OFM research and development organization that I mentioned earlier. Now, the technology at the time, in 1961, was really an afterthought for agent operations. There really wasn't much that we had to do. There were no covert communications transmitters, there was no special audio devices, audio bugs that were used. In fact, most of the work at the time had to do with secret writing, preparing special chemicals for secret writing, or making clothing for people, infiltrators that we wanted to send back into Eastern Europe or the Soviet Union, so they would help the citizens of those countries when they went back in. That evolved very quickly. By the mid-1950s, OTS, or TSS, Technical Services Staff, had become heavily involved, first in the reconnaissance aircraft program, and secondly, in a variety of electronics and that kind of gadgets. The revolution for American spy technology occurred in 1959, with 50 years of their history, with the patenting of the integrated circuit. And the integrated circuit gave the
in terms of, and it is what I mentioned earlier, in terms of the uses of technology, and of course we can't get into many ways that it can be used, but is there a prototypical example in your mind of where technology has directly helped the mission of CIA, and similarly, are there examples or remain example of where technology or the use of technology is actually hindered or backfired in the CIA's operations?
If I could pick up on my example of the integrated circuit that was now available to us by 1961 in quantity, the CIA technical people developed a whole series of bugs. We called them FRT, surveillance receiver transmitter. And these small bugs were able to be implanted, installed in buildings, in walls, in furniture, in desks, in virtually any kind of a wooden or masonry structure any place in the world. The parallel development has been with the power sources, with batteries. The technical people were able to achieve remarkable reliability and longevity with quite small batteries at the time, actually leading to some commercial applications, perhaps most notably in hearing aids and in heart pacemakers.
When we think about yes, I did, and that's what I was going to follow up on, so please.
Yeah. think that they wouldn't tell otherwise, and B, what were the defensive mechanisms against those? Well, I think it was experiments developed, they really led to a dead end in terms of any real scientific value, but they led to a nasty situation with respect to the CIA being doing all kinds of nefarious drug testing on large numbers that are done with people around the country, and the case being well publicized then during those hearings that we referred to also as kidnapping killings.
Well, you're talking to Bob Wallace, one of the co-authors of Spycraft, The Secret History of the CIA Spy Techs from Communism to Al-Qaeda, here on Hearsay Culture. Bob, we have about 12 minutes left, and I do want to touch a little bit on some modern issues. I recognize that you can't get into or discuss operations, current operations, and so forth, but perhaps we can speak in more general terms about some of the issues that we're facing as we think about technology and the use of technology in 2009. And one of the things that you talk about towards the end of the book is what you described as personal database information and how that information can be used in recruiting efforts and so forth within CIA. And perhaps I'll ask you about that. How does, and when I think about this, I'm thinking about data mining and data aggregation on individuals. How does that technology or the use of that technology impact CIA operations? And again, I'm speaking in very general terms and not speaking of anything specifically, but how, perhaps I can ask the question this way, how is that data useful perhaps to an organization like CIA?
In terms of technology espionage operation, two major revolutions during my lifetime, and I'm several years older than you, Dave, so probably spoke didn't occur during your lifetime, but I mentioned the integrated circuit in 1959, which was remarkable in terms of the kind of electronic technology that it brought to bear on our operations, clandestine operations. The second revolution was 1992 to 1993, it had a specific date on it, but during those, suddenly we had worldwide 24/7 assured communications. We had the internet. We had data storage now measured in terabytes and instantly available to us. We had a digital revolution underway that would fundamentally change the nature of information. Information became a commodity. It became free. It became easily accessible. We also had network computers, which, if you think that this is pretty fascinating, because before we had network computers, the only network of information was really human beings networking, telling each other, communicating with each other. Now we have computers communicating vast amounts of information constantly. This all led to the ability, not of government, but of the private sector, private entrepreneurs, to collect remarkable sums of information, databases of information, and it was information that was both always available and always there. So if I can use this one example, all of us who might use Facebook for these kinds of ways to communicate about our life as we are growing up, through high school, through college, into our early adult years, there's a remarkable amount of personal information that's just out there and it's just sitting out there. That's one intelligence service. One intelligence service, I think, is the whole area of how Americans can defend themselves from hostile intelligence service. information about a person or an individual target just by manipulating the keyboard. It doesn't take very much time, it doesn't take very much effort, really. And you can do it just as easily in Shanghai or in Novosibirsk or take any country that you can take around the world. You don't even have to come to the NFL to get it.
You mentioned something which I think is definitely worth exploring, and something we haven't explored directly on Hearsay Culture. I mean, we on this show, I've had a number of people on who have discussed consumer protection issues, and in fact, coming up in this quarter, we're going to have on a guest, Fresher Morell Hildebrand, who's written on profiling efforts in the EU and how data is used to profile EU citizens. But you mentioned something which I don't think gets much attention, but something I think we can discuss, which is the use of this information by a hostile intelligence entities or by others seeking to do us harm. Now, when we think about that generally on the internet, we think about people running financial scams or with children, with child predators, and so forth. But you're talking about something quite different. So perhaps you could expand on that. And what would be your advice or your concern as addressed to, say, your average Facebook user as it relates to how that data might be used by a foreign intelligence service?
First element is awareness, and in fact, that may be 95% of anything we want to say relative to protection of our own information. The ability to aggregate personal information, to mine it and to aggregate it, is just phenomenal. Now, 99+% of us folks aren't going to take any foreign intelligence services are not going to take any particular interest. The problem, Dave, is that 20 years ago, that was kind of the only people you had to worry about were sophisticated foreign intelligence services. Today, as you rightly said, that's the worry about predators. You worry about criminals, you have to be concerned about terror, you have to be just concerned about people who, for whatever reason, want to do you harm. Because revolution, information revolution, has literally made data formally only accessible by governments and by sophisticated intelligence services, available to anyone who wants to devote the time and effort to get it.
In order to, and in the remaining 5 or 6 minutes here, I think it would be useful to discuss where we're going from here. This show is being recorded on January 19th, and tomorrow a new president is going to be inaugurated. CIA has gotten a lot of attention, a lot of it negative, in recent press involving intelligence gathering techniques and alleged use of torture and so forth. In terms of the use of technology, however, I think less is discussed outside of particular circles that are concerned about issues like privacy and government transparency and so forth. What, based upon your experience, what do you see, say, in the next 4 or 5 years or so in terms of the use of technology by the intelligence services in light of what may very well be a significant policy change at the top level between the current administration, the Bush administration, and the Obama administration? For example, you know, the appointment of Leon Panetta, who is in many ways an outsider to CIA, is an interesting choice. What's your view and, you know, prognostication in the last 5 minutes of the show is always an unfair thing to do, but how do you see the use of technology manifesting itself in the coming administration?
Well, technology will not regress, but technology will continue to expand the capabilities that already exist, and no doubt there will be some minimum service by every administration, but it will be serious and continuing attention. To the national security of technology will be organization around national security and all that. We should go to the national security, but all of them are certainly going to be continuing to make probably amazing progress in applying the technology to the national security problem.
Do you anticipate any perhaps? Especially as things like data aggregation come to the fore, any backlash against or efforts to perhaps rein in the use of this technology by CIA or by other or by law enforcement here in the United States as more people become aware of its potential uses, both both good and bad. So the and of course you're referring to things like audio monitors that you put in your infant's room.
Sure, yeah, audio, video, in the crib, you know. Fortunately, my children are adults now. I would have loved to have one of those monitors in the car to know where they went and how fast they were going.
Mm-hmm. And so you anticipate that manifesting itself how? I think it's perhaps, Bob, in closing, maybe a topic of your next book. Certainly, I think it's an interesting question, and it's one perhaps that would be good, if not a little concerning, to close on here. Bob, thank you for joining us today, discussing your book, Spycraft, The Secret History of the CIA Spy Text from Communism to Al-Qaeda. For those people who want to learn more about the book, I understand that you have a website.
We sure do. That website is www.ciaspycraft.com, www.ciaspycraft. It will provide you some other information about the book. It will give you reviews and comments, good, bad, and indifferent, and provide you a place for you to order the book if you'd like, or it's also available at your local bookstore.
Bob Wallace, thank you for joining us today on Hearsay Culture and for discussing this very, very, I think, timely and interesting history of the use of technology by CIA. We are...
Thank you, Bob.
I'm very excited as we go through this quarter to mention a number of guests coming up, as well as some guests that even in the last couple of weeks I've been able to arrange and look forward to talking to in the spring. Coming up soon will be, among other people, Professor Ned Snow from the University of Arkansas, discussing an article that he wrote called Copy Traps. Andrew Luman and Wendy Seltz will be on discussing the Tor project using anonymity servers for communications on the Internet. Nick Carr, the author of Big Switch, will be on the show. Professor Paul Heald from the University of Georgia will be on later in this quarter. As I previously mentioned, Professor Morell Hildebrandt will be on discussing her edited book, Profiling the European Citizen. As I previously mentioned, we're also going to be talking to Kevin Bankston from the Electronic Frontier Foundation, discussing his work there. And then going into the spring quarter, so these are shows that will be airing probably starting sometime in mid-April. I'm very excited to mention that Professor Mark Lemley and Dan Burke will be on the show discussing their book coming out later, actually in a few months perhaps, on patent law reform. Professor Jamie Boyle from Duke University Law School will be on the show discussing a public domain. Several guests from the Canadian intellectual property technology world will be on the show as well. Professor Michael Deist and Ron Diebert will be on the show discussing their work with respect to copyright, as well as Ron Diebert's Citizen Lab. Corey Doctorow from Boing Boing will be on the show discussing his most recent compendium of essays called Content. Professor Small, Gary Small, who's written a book called iBrain, The Impact of Technology on the Human Brain, will be on the show. That's a fascinating book, and I'm looking forward to talking to him, as well as Professor Michael Heller from Columbia University Law School. So I'm in the process of continuing to find what I hope and expect to be very interesting and exciting guests here on the show. And as always, I welcome your feedbacks, comments, suggestions, and so forth by emailing me at dave@hearsayculture.com. As always, you can listen to the show any number of ways on KZSU-FM Stanford, 90.1 FM, from 5 to 6 Pacific time on Wednesdays. You can also cast the show through the iTunes page for the Center for Internet Society at Stanford Law School, where you can find the podcast feed. You can get an RSS podcast feed as well through CIS's main website at cyberlaw.stanford.edu. And last but not least, you can always pick up the show as well as schedule previous shows, commentary, by going to hearsayculture.com. Thanks again for listening to Hearsay Culture today. I hope you've enjoyed the interview, and please stay tuned to KZSU for more diverse programming. Have a great day.